This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Wow, hello. It is May 10, 2019. This is just a Boom-style surprise podcast thing using the power of the internet. Today we're talking to Kevin and Scott Kuhn.
Hello.
Whoa. So an interesting thing is, like, what would you say you do here?
Anything not related to tech.
Yeah, so that's crazy. Tell your story.
So I finally had a camel, and someone put a straw in his back, and it broke. And it broke, I'm going to say about May or April of last year. And I decided this is my last tech job. And I decided to do something else. And my wife suggested I go into teaching. And I said, hey, you know, I got this bachelor's of science in biochem laying around. I'll teach science to like high school kids and middle school kids. We'll see how that goes. So I decided to do, I looked into the certification and all that stuff, and I decided I'd do a online master's of teaching / education through Western Governors University, WGU. They offer completely online courses. A little different than distance learning. It's just completely online. Everything is, it's amazing and yet frustrating with the level of technology that I have. Because, and we can get into that some too, but, then in October, around there, there was a lot of changes at work and I was let go. And I just, we'd already kind of planned that my exit was going to happen once I got into the program. Mm-hmm. And it finally ended up happening in February of this year. I got into the program and started actual classes, but so it wasn't like a big problem. I started substitute teaching for the local high school and middle school around here. It's pretty fun. I may do some like freelance tech work in the summers, just kind of as a summer job or, you know, as needed. We'll see how that goes. So I'm about three quarters of the way through my first semester of doing this master's program, and I'm enjoying it.
Wow. Okay, so what advice would you give? Somebody listening is going, that is exactly what I want to do. What advice, what would you do different, or what worked well or whatever?
Definitely have a very supportive spouse and or partner. Yeah. And save up while you're at your current horrible tech job in this toxic, terrible tech industry. Save as much as you can so that you can coast, because there's a lot of homework, and I haven't done homework in 25 years. So I'm relearning how to learn.
Wow.
Like having to write papers and research things. And it's been interesting. The one thing I haven't missed was being on the treadmill, the hamster wheel of tech updates. So you'll see me occasionally on Twitter, like, ha ha, you suckers. You guys have to hang on everyone's word from build. That's fine. Yeah. Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah. Cool. Well, what's changed about learning? Like you mentioned the kind of different models of like online learning and stuff. What's changed about learning since, you know, we were wee lads?
So they don't use Latin anymore. There's no cuneiform or stone tablets. No. So it's interesting because one of the first jobs that I had was creating an online training course for nursing homes back in the late 90s, working at a company that was doing that. And that was kind of like the beginning of everything online, and to see how far it's come and to see how they've integrated the different technology is both fascinating and frustrating, because they have like, I don't know, like 15 or 20 partner sites that, you know, provide the content and or the testing and the single sign-on, the Federation doesn't work seamlessly like you would think it would in 2019. Mm-hmm. So like you'll be in a window, you'll be watching a video and your account will time out on the main portal window. And then when you try to click on a link in the window where you're watching a video or something, it'll redirect you to the partner's login page. And you're like, I don't know what my login is because I just clicked on a link from the portal. So you like have to go all the way back. It's kind of like an old Super Nintendo game without save points. It's like, well, nope, sorry. Your princess is in another castle. You have to go back to the beginning, sign in there, follow the links through to get back to where you were. So that part's kind of frustrating. But, you know, I pretty much had to deal with that with the Azure portal and everything else. So it's nothing that I'm not used to. And the other interesting thing is that the online testing, they actually have, of course, like proctor.com or something where they sign in using, kind of like a nanny program or a desktop watching program where they'll actually have you on camera and they watch you when you take the test.
Oh, right.
And they screen capture everything and they have a script, like a WSI script that goes through and shuts down all the, you know, unnecessary or unneeded programs on your computer. You know, like first thing I thought of was, oh, what? Someone could cheat easily with Dropbox, right? Because just have someone sync the links there, the answers over to a test. No, they shut down Dropbox and they monitor your processes to make sure that it doesn't start up. They watch what you do on the screen. They capture everything. And they have a camera pointed at you and you have to show all around your room. I thought, well, that's pretty interesting.
Wow.
That's a fascinating way to do this kind of testing.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And then the other nice thing is, you know, back when we were in college, like it could take a week or two before maybe you got your test results back. You know, I'm getting them in 10 minutes, if not instantaneously now. It's like I take a test, I submit it. 10 minutes later, like, oh, you passed. Congratulations. Oh, okay. Wow. There's a lot of... I was almost going to say synergy, but a lot of integration with Microsoft Office, Google Docs. They use Gmail for all the school email, everything else.
So that's interesting to me because I've got three kids in school now, and a lot of stuff is Google Classroom related. Like it's not just Google. It's not just Gmail, but it's Google Docs and Google Slides and like everything Google.
Yeah, and like a lot of the classes that I sub in, they all go and get their Chromebooks and go to you know, what was one they had called like redline.com or redsquiggles.com where they do English lessons, them prepared. And it's just, you know, they sign in as them. They all have school logins, sign into a Chromebook, go to the site, it pulls up their assignment, they do the assignment right there and submit it and then come and ask me what to do. And I say, I don't know, work on your math.
So are there places where having, you know, tech background, you look at stuff and you're like, well, duh, why don't they just do this instead? Or, you know, things that are most frustrating.
I am seeing, I'm seeing a lot of places where I'm like, or things where I'm like, you know, when I have a classroom, I'm going to integrate this because this is going to make it a lot easier. It's kind of like the best and the worst of corporate land where, you know, they'll pick a CMS and that's what they're stuck with. And then the CMS doesn't quite do what they need. So they've got all these hinky workarounds and stuff that they do. And every school district is different because they all have their own software. But it's still kind of amazing. I do kind of grin whenever like I sit down and I try the sub login to the teacher's computer and it doesn't work. And I call the office and like, well, you need to call tech support. And I'm like, there's nothing that they're going to tell me that I don't already know or haven't tried.
Right.
I've tried turning it off and on again. It's definitely a fizzbin. Like, actually, no, could you come down? We've got another question. Sorry, Mr. Kuhn, could you come and we're trying to troubleshoot our Azure site. What? Okay. No, no, I won't.
Well, it does seem like there's a lot of different kind of solutions that are all kind of cobbled together in interesting ways. Like there's so many different ways of a teacher can create their own site and interact with students. And there's so many ways of like sharing documents and so many ways of creating presentations or sharing files or all this stuff. And then they kind of like, they just cobble everything together like most kind of small businesses do. And like, you know what I mean? It's
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. One thing that is kind of amazing is how much password and user management they do for not having single sign-on capabilities. This is just something that I noticed kind of on the side was, you know, they can't, kids can't remember, you know, 29 passwords like we have to, mm-hmm. you know, which email did I use for this site? And no, they get one school login and then that school password. And, you know, that gives them access to everything. The computers are locked down if they're not Chromebooks. If they're Windows PCs, they're locked down. But then they make sure that any additional site that the kids might have to go to either has a single shared logon, like, you know, the school name or school district.
Oh, right.
You know, password is password or something like that.
It's basically just like a guest account.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Or they've either, you know, or they've created a list of users and passwords that kids already have in the existing network, and they've sent it to the site to say, okay, put these users in the system so that they can use the same username and password, even though the site is not affiliated or tied in or federated or anything. It's just, right. just the same thing, you know, like we do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, you know, like, I've noticed like an interesting thing with my kids where they'll like, if they forget the password to something, instead of like reset password or anything, they're just like, I'll just create a new account. Like,
exactly.
You know, like for me. Yeah. It's like no big deal. It's like, whatever. You just grow up creating accounts and not caring about them. To me, it's like, no, this is your name on this same service. And like, whatever.
Yeah. Cause like, I'm not going to pay attention to any emails that I get from this site. So I don't care.
Right. They don't even know their email password or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, so how do you communicate with students then? Like, is it just Gmail or different things?
Well, since I'm just a sub, you know, I'm just there for the day.
Oh, right.
You know, I don't really have to communicate with them, but they do have, they've got this, well, specifically the district that I'm working in, they've got an online system that's, you know, third party or whatever called Skyward that they input all the grades into and allows the teachers to email, you know, bulk email everyone in their class. So mm-hmm. like the band teacher will send out notifications for events that are coming up to all the parents, whatever email addresses the parents have put on file, just can bulk send it out. It's also how they keep track of attendance and, like I said, the grades, but it also integrates like lunchroom credit. You know, so when the, mm-hmm. and this is all stuff that as parents, we all have to deal with too.
So this is where Ferris Bueller would hack in and change, get rid of his 9 absences.
That's exactly their single system where he could, you know, log in and hack it and change it all. Or Bill Gates would do that, I guess.
Right. Okay. So one thing that's come up for me recently in discussing with my kids and as they're learning in school is there was a whole thing for a while, and I'm assuming it's still like this, where they keep telling kids Wikipedia is not reliable. It's not a reliable source, whatever, because yes. anyone can edit it and stuff. But then on the other hand, they don't tell kids, watch out for YouTubers, because they'll tell you all kinds of ridiculous stuff and there's no way to edit or correct them.
Oh, they're starting.
So I'm like arguing with
they're starting to now.
What's that?
They're starting to, you know, have more online literacy like courses or not necessarily courses, but supplemental instruction, like and that's what my kid does. She goes and watches some science show and he talks about how, you know, the earth is flat or something, and I'm like, come on.
Right.
And she's gotten pretty good. They both watch a lot of YouTube. One of them is more into like little dramatic anime stuff and the other is into just friggin' everything. But at school they are starting to do a little bit more of the online, and especially more of the online security. So, you know, don't ever give your real name online. Don't ever give your location, phone number, et cetera. A lot of information around who to text and how to text to. Cause like my girls, my older girl, she's a teenager now. So if you go back to clear in the archives, you hear a little girl, you know, talking on one of our podcasts. She's now 13 and she's like up to my ear, literally. She's tall. And she uses this app called Amino, which I don't know if any of you two have heard of that, but it's like an online community kind of thing. So it's like Facebook, but without the Russian influence. It's just all these kids get together and, you know, they have group chats, but it's not through like SMS or anything. It's just through this Amino app. And they can upload art and share with each other and blah, 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 blah.
So like a private, so you said Amino?
Yeah.
Like amino acid?
Okay. Yep, exactly.
And so it's kind of like a private Facebook, kind of?
Kind of. It's more oriented towards kids and creative types. So there's a lot of, I think they actually advertise as like a fan-based community. So you'll see lots of more like Facebook groups on there. You'll see, she got into it. She was a big fan of this fantasy book series called Wings of Fire. And so her friends all told her about this and she got on there and she can upload pictures of her dragons and whatnot. And she can see other people's pictures and they kind of chat about it. But it kind of morphed into more of a, oh, this is our own little private, you know, just my friend's book.
Yeah.
Instead of Facebook where I, you know, can see anything.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole kind of, it's interesting, the whole kind of online communities and kids and how they're set up in that way. Even like my youngest is on Minecraft, like servers and building challenges and how they have like moderators. And my kid's like, I can't wait till I turn 13. I can be a mod, you know? Oh yeah.
Yeah. The power, my, you know? My youngest one is on Roblox. She plays Roblox across multiple devices. Anything she can get her hands on, she'll install Roblox on. And I don't know if you guys have ever played Roblox. It's kind of like Minecraft, but instead of building a world, you're building games. So they can build their own little games in there. There's one that she likes to play where they just pretend like they're in this royal high school or something. And they all role play as, you know, a princess or somebody going to high school there. But anyway, it allows chat. And one of the more troublesome things we have is, you know, we gotta log in to see who she's chatting with and what she's saying to them.
Right, right.
And we occasionally get these little questions like, hey, Daddy, can you get me a Skype account? I'm like, what do you need a Skype account for? It's like, so I can talk to my friends online. No, you cannot have a Skype account. Well, can I get a headset? Why? So I can talk to them through Roblox. No, because we don't know nobody on no Roblox.
Yeah. It is super interesting. But like going back a ways, it is good that they are teaching them like online safety. There was a thing where my kid was chatting with somebody on this server and I was like, hey, do you know about being safe? And she went down this list. She's like, never give location, never did this, always assume this, blah, blah, blah. You know, like they do drill it into them, which is good.
Yeah, it's almost like you want to sit down and watch old Catch a Predator reruns on YouTube with them. Go, look, see all these creepy guys? That's who you're chatting with.
Yeah.
What was another interesting part? They do say don't use Wikipedia as a source. But when I talk to my kids about it, I'm like, so the well-edited Wikipedia articles will have citations at the bottom.
Exactly. This drives me nuts. I'm always like, the teachers are like, the competition for kids, like authority and what they learn and all that is not between Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica. It's between Wikipedia and YouTube and like random, you know what I mean? And it's like out of all those Wikipedia is at least like sourced and updated and community edited and
well, some parts
monitored.
There's still some crazy parts.
Sure. But in general, like if somebody defaces a page or whatever, like it's usually pretty quickly. Like I trust it more than I trust basically any. What I trust YouTube for is information on how to fix my sink. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like if I want to do some yard maintenance or whatever.
Oh my God.
I watch
yes.
YouTube.
I use, oh, all the time. Like our furnace went out and I'm looking up how to disassemble our furnace. What to troubleshoot, yep. How to light the pilot. And they
yeah.
You know, got videos of people showing me how to do it. So what I told my girls was if you find a Wikipedia article that has the information you want, look around the information to see if it's cited, then go use that mm-hmm. site as your citation in your research. So click through the
Google.
Link. Yeah. Go click through the link to the actual, you know, site that's listing the information. Use that as your source instead of Wikipedia so you don't get dinged.
Cool. Well, I'm not sure this is a slightly awkward transition, but the three things I was interested in talking about, one was your exciting adventure, but two and three on the list were ones that are tech related. So I don't know if you're just going to want to just stand there with thumbs down and go boo, boo the whole time, but...
Well, the two of them I thought were interesting. The Windows Terminal one, which is exciting,
yeah.
But looked exactly like Midnight Commander to me. And I'm like, what is Miguel doing over there? What has he done to them?
Well, right. Well, so the Windows Terminal is themable too, which is kind of neat.
Yeah.
And it's a JSON file, which this is not. Yeah.
So you have to come out with a hot dog theme.
Right, right.
Hot dog stand theme. That's a given. The second
it is kind of cool. Yeah.
The signing of packages, I think. Was that what it is through GitHub?
Well, there's a lot of so GitHub came out with they announced a package registry, which includes a lot of different things. So there's NPM, there's NuGet, there's Docker, there's Gems, there's Maven. So I think the idea is actually hosting the packages. Now, I don't know if they announced, I didn't actually get to see the announcement. I don't know if they announced something on like the signing and the ownership of the packages. I don't know. Kevin, did you see anything on that?
I didn't.
Yeah. That's a hard problem.
I didn't actually watch the announcement, but I was a little unclear. Like, is there, so like with NPM, for example, you like when you upload a package to NPM, like it's separate storage from the source, which is presumably living in GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
So is this like removing that intermediate layer and like the source in GitHub is also the source in the package manager, or is it like, do they have some, like I was unclear on that part.
Yeah. And you know, honestly, I know what I read. My understanding is in the same way that you can do like a release on GitHub, you know, for a binary release, you can also host a package as well. And it is kind of interesting how GitHub's moving to like, you know, now they have like some GitHub Actions. You can do like CI/CD stuff. And so it moves from just hosting your source to actually doing builds and doing, you know, you can have binary releases and you can have package releases. So it's all kind of like one place instead of all these different intermediary things. I could see also that you could use it for something like a nightly feed, but then like the officials still maybe still on NPM or NuGet, but like you have a, you know, kind of in the way that there have been some others, you know, like MyGet or something like that, where you have a, you know what I mean? Like a nightly or a per build feed.
Or like your own personal, you got to authenticate to this register
yeah.
thing. Like that's what we mainly used MyGit for. That's
yeah.
the last place yep. I was at. I don't miss that.
One thing that seems interesting to me, I mean, number one, like this isn't just packages. This is even like Docker, which is kind of crazy. But then two is, I don't know if there are other package registries like this. All the package registries I'm aware of till now are focused on one type of package, like NPM's all, you know, node packages,
right.
You know, or JavaScript related. And the others are all like NuGet is pretty much mostly .NET assemblies and stuff. So I don't know what happens when you have like a registry of everything.
Yeah. So do they register a new, are they using a new protocol for fetching, or are they passing along a header that says, oh, I want the NPM version of this, or
I don't know.
I mean, from the description on the webpage, like, you just point the existing NPM client at this as a new registry. So it's not, they haven't like invented their own protocol.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just have to have the URL and then you just say, oh, go get me this thing. It's there. Okay.
Yeah.
But you know, like in NPM land, one of the issues is that it's a global namespace. I mean, there's obviously you can have, you know, scoped packages, but kind of the default is global namespace, which is already a problem just in NPM land. Like, I'm assuming they're not going to do that across every package manager or across every packaging system, because that would be a land rush of epic proportions.
Yeah, it's true. Where will the real left pad please stand up?
Or more than likely, when everyone starts uploading their Windows Server 2000 Docker images at, you know, six gig a pop.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I don't know. I am happy about it personally. For my job stuff, we have different package feeds and we have different, you know, projects we support and stuff. And this is definitely handy from that point of view. And they do offer some of this stuff with Azure DevOps. But I feel like, you know, like just having a GitHub and the source code and everything kind of, I don't know, it seems pretty simple, at least like as far as a, like for me, the nightly builds and the per, you know, like I can already easily do like a per, you know, every time I check in, it builds a release, might as well.
But we always use like TeamCity or CI for hosting those kinds of feeds. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little concerned about it. Like, I don't, this idea of like bifurcating the packaging system concerns me. You know, it's like everything lives on NPM, except now it doesn't. Now it could be split across NPM or GitHub. And like, what does that do to the community? And what does that do to the, you know, does that sort of fragment the community?
Well, Kevin, there's always teaching. Summer off, weekend.
Not that concerned about it.
I mean, I guess from my, like what I've been working with, it's I'm in more bifurcated worlds already because I work with NuGet and MyGet pretty often for NuGet things. And then I think about CDNs and some stuff's on CDNJS and some's on JS Deliver and some's here and some's there. So, I mean, I don't know from that where, and I guess another thing, and I'm not up on all the drama so much, but I know there is drama in the NPM world.
Oh, it's just because they're hiring and firing practices, right?
Right.
Some people got let go, and I was like, oh, really? Yeah, welcome to tech.
I heard it's about ethics and game journalism.
Yeah, it is. And honestly, like, you know, NPM is a company that's trying to, like, make enough revenue to survive, and they're hosting this insanely high volume packaging system.
Yeah, it's in a way it's it does work, but it's crazy that it does. Like the huge, like you're saying, it's huge scale.
I mean, it's like billions of packages installed every month. So, is this just going to like siphon away users from that service, and it's going to, you know, that business is not going to be able to survive because of it? That doesn't seem like a good thing. I mean, maybe some people will be happy that, you know, that happens, but like NPM, I mean, GitHub's just another company. It's not like it's suddenly transitioning into some community owned, you know, system. It would just be transferring the locus of power from one company to another. So, you know, I definitely have some concerns about this.
Yeah.
I mean, mostly from an NPM perspective, because that's the community I live in now.
So,
you know, Docker Hub is the same thing though, right? Like Docker Hub is a business. They're trying to make a business and they charge money for that service. And so is GitHub just going to now slurp away all their customers?
Yeah. And like you said, I mean, Docker Hub, the Docker business also supports development of Docker, doesn't it? And NPM supports some node development related stuff, like the NPM client and stuff like that, right?
Exactly. Right. So now, like, they're going to take all that business away? I don't know. It seems a little bit skeezy to me.
Why, yes, NPM does develop the NPM client. Not very well, but yes.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know. All right, stay tuned, I guess. Let's go back to that terminal. So in addition to the different different like ways of look, like it also has tabs, which is kind of neat, finally. What are some other features? I should know offhand. This is one of the most things that Microsoft releases, and then people are like assuming I knew about it ahead of time and I didn't, and it's embarrassing. But this is one of the few things where I actually did have the pre-release installed. It has been pretty nice. Tabs is definitely, what's that? Yeah, so I'm trying to think what other sorts of features. There are some things where you can kind of configure different per tab things. So you can say, when I open up this one, do a, you know, an admin PowerShell and stuff. Oh, and then there is also, it's interesting now too with Terminal these days, being able to, like, because there's OpenSSH built into Windows, and then there's also stuff. I mean, I guess this is not the same thing, but it seems related. Is that also there's the remote access stuff. So now VS Code can open stuff remotely too, like into a Docker container or, you know, Linux, you know, anything. Like, so that's kind of neat.
Yeah. So basically, they just looked at what Commander and what's the other like multi-tab command line.
Yeah, well, there's Hyper is one I've been using.
The Hyper.js one.
ConEmu.
Yeah. That's the one that we use a lot. Yeah. And they said, hey, let's embrace and extend and that.
Well, or on the other hand, everybody else has every other operating system has a decent
terminal.
Terminal.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
That's what I thought. I was like, oh, look, they finally get colors and curses. That's really cool.
And it is open source, so that's cool. I have tried to build it, and it wasn't super smooth, although they are updating that now. Because it's C++, but like it's a Visual Studio 2017 solution, and it is using the like Windows I think it's UWP stuff, but there's several different toolkits you have to install. But they're simplifying that.
So is this something that's going to ship as part of Windows?
Yeah.
And is this also the first like open source thing that's part of Windows itself?
Surprisingly not. I talked to somebody at Build and that was showing off the calculator, and calculator is open source.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I thought the,
That's pretty recent.
I thought the DNS and all that stuff from way back in NT was based on Debian code.
There was some stuff that was related, but it wasn't like a Microsoft project that,
you know,
I think it was more they were distributing something.
Yeah, okay.
The calculator one was actually really interesting to me. They were showing that and they were like talking. I was talking to the guy about like, how they scaled because there was a small team that was supporting all these like these applications, you know, like calculator, and he didn't list the other ones, but I'm assuming, you know, some of those sort of utility ones.
Solitaire.
And, who knows? Yeah. You know, on the one hand, it's like, hey, it's calculator. How hard can it be? Whatever. But then on the other hand, people like use it for calculation, like billions of people have it on their computer and use it for calculations. And sometimes those calculations are kind of important. And there's all kinds of weird stuff about floating point on different CPUs and whatever kind of, you know. And so anyhow, I think it is nice that it is open source. And already, like, once it was put out there, then, you know, they got flooded with pull requests. And then they're adding in some features like graphing and stuff.
Can it read email yet?
So.
Isn't that Atwood's law?
I don't know. The feature list for what Adobe Acrobat does. No. I forget all the things.
No, don't talk about Adobe.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyhow, that was pretty interesting. I got a fancy calculator sticker from the guy, and
yeah. Man, everybody's got stickers, including sub-teams in Microsoft.
It was a hex sticker with a calculator on it. That's pretty slick. Well, but then also it updates through the Windows Store.
Hexadecimal sticker?
Nice. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know.
Is that how Terminal is going to update too, through the Windows Store?
You know, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Is the Windows Store still a thing?
Well, so if you think of it in terms, I know, it's not like you're going to go buy stuff there, but in terms of updating stuff on my Windows box, it is kind of nice. Like I've been testing the Terminal Nightly thing, and it's, I get it through the store, and it's just like, it actually does have a pretty smooth model for just
so that stuff. That's weird, because it seems like the Windows Terminal stuff should come through Windows Update, right?
I don't know. I mean,
not Windows Store.
Well, isn't an application?
It's a good question. Yeah.
And this is one of those things too, where I'm not sure. The two may live side by side. I wouldn't be surprised, because, like, you know, all the Raymond Chen articles from a long time back where they talk about people depend on quirky, wacky 20-year-old behavior of every EXE Microsoft's ever shipped, right?
So we have a macro that uses calculator to calculate our TPI, and
yeah,
if calculator does not have these exact dimensions, our macro doesn't work.
Exactly. But yeah, the actual kind of like updating of stuff, like usually what I'm noticing is when Windows Update finishes, then the store will like go and grab some new stuff. So there's like, you know, I don't know if they key it off of this store update requires this version of Windows or something like that. But usually I'm on the Windows Insider fast track, so I update like all the time, and like once a week or something. And I noticed that, well, first of all, they have actually made the updates run a lot faster. But then once the updates finish, then in the background, like the store is like grabbing these like little utility things and updating. So like the store, the mail, the photos app, like all that stuff where it's like, I don't need you to slow my computer down and make me wait for the Windows update to finish for it. But eventually when I go and, you know, edit a photo using MS Paint or whatever, like, sure, go ahead, update that. So
it's like the paint.net thing where every time you try to open it, it says, hey, there's an update. Do you want to install it now or when you close?
Right. No, it actually does it kind of, it doesn't nag you at all. It's like async sort of. So I don't, yeah. The one thing that does do that, but I think kind of is not annoying, is is VS Code. It does updates, but it does them on shutdown, which is like the way God intended, right? So like,
or it'll like pre-download them and then say, oh, we'll update when you shut down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's actually not cool.
So what else was mentioned at Build?
Uh-oh.
Some new name for .NET 5?
Yeah.
Is it Hailstorm? Is that what they're calling it?
So I need to be careful to not say the wrong thing, because there's so many like careful messaging things on it. But basically .NET 5 is the next .NET. So it's like all the stuff that was in .NET Core, instead of having like, here's .NET Framework, here's .NET Core, and blah, blah, blah. And people are confused, and CTOs are confused because they're like, okay, if I'm choosing between .NET Core 3 and .NET Framework 4.8, I better use .NET Framework 4.8 because that's the bigger number, and, you know, all this stuff. So I think part of the thing is to just make it really clear, like .NET 5 is the .NET. If you're doing new development, you should be using .NET 5.
No, just a second. CTOs are confused because they're a few brain cells short of being talking monkeys. That's why CTOs are confused by all this.
Well, there may be that. I make no official statement either way on this. But, so I think that's kind of the thing. And then they talked about, also there's a kind of a unification of Mono and .NET finally.
Well, I saw somebody, despite my best intents and efforts, some of the MS Build stuff leaked through my Twitter feed. And
you didn't block all the terms?
Didn't block everything or everybody. But somebody like posted something. Now all of the platform is unified. You can write .NET for everything. And I was, you know, in my head, I added again.
Yeah. Okay. So So my thought, like the history of stuff, right? There was .NET framework, and it was old and you know, like
in the beginning, right?
And then there was Mono, which is neat, but it was a separate implementation, and it runs on your PlayStation, and it runs on your, you know, toaster, and it runs on everything that Microsoft was never going to ship support for, and including like Mac and Linux to some level, right? So then, then Microsoft buys Xamarin, and then also separately, the ASP.NET team is like, hey, how can we not suck and be as fast as Node and everything? So then they kind of Skunkworks build Project K, which was then DNX, which was then .NET Core, and when they started building, historifying it. But when they started building that, the ASP.NET team and the .NET teams were separate. So this was just built for ASP.NET, right? Okay, so then the .NET team and the ASP.NET team unify. So there is a unifying thing. And then the Mono team, like, is being part of Microsoft, well, Xamarin being part of Microsoft, and also because .NET Core was open sourced, so they were able to directly reference the code as opposed to like white room implement it like spec for spec. So anyhow, now then they had the historic .NET framework stuff, and then they had .NET Core. And then after a while, it's like, why do we have to use the word core? Because it's not like this tiny core anymore, and it's a confusing name and stuff. And then I guess the unifying part of it is the like actually unifying more directly with Mono. So it's, oh, and along the way also there was .NET Standard. And the idea with .NET Standard is like, okay, we're going to declare the standard. And if you write a library for .NET Standard version, whatever, that's going to work on this version of .NET Framework, this version of .NET Core, and this version of Mono. So it's kind of a bridge, but it's still like, well, you have to develop to the standard, and then people get confused by that too. So I think the idea here now is like new development, develop for .NET 5, and .NET 5 runs on all the stuff.
So if you have a like a classic .NET 4 based application, mm-hmm. do you then take that to .NET 5? Is .NET 5 a superset? Is there stuff in .NET 4 that is not ever going to be part of .NET 5? I'm confused about this.
Yeah, and those are all the right questions. So I think of .NET 5 as the next .NET Core. So the stuff that what does come? Okay, first of all, you know, the disclaimer: if you have working stuff that works on .NET Framework, you don't have to update it. It's going to be, you know, supported, maintained, kind of forever. It's just not going to get new features. So it gets new security things. It gets, you know, support for important like identity, you know, things or whatever. But it doesn't get new big features. So the stuff that does move smoothly to some degree of smoothly to .NET Core. Like number one, library code generally moves over pretty smoothly. Like, so if you have, you know, a NuGet package that does X, you know, that, you know, adds commas to things or parses JSON or whatever. They did originally, especially when they did .NET Core 2, they did a ton of work to like make the APIs compatible and stuff. So they did scans over the NuGet packages, and they found that like, I think it was way over 70%, like just without any changes, continued to work on .NET Core. So library code moves over smoothly. Web stuff moves over relatively smoothly if you're doing MVC or, you know, like modern web dev. If you're doing web forms, not really. And that's where it's something like, you know, you're going to have to do some sort of update. There's some like bridge technologies like .vvm is an open source project, or there's Blazor, there's different things like that. But so web forms will not come up to
actually I did look at this. I looked at this once.
And
even if you're doing MVC stuff, it's pretty much a rewrite to go to .NET next, or ASP.NET next at least. For every project I looked at, which was three of them, written by a variety of different skill levels and with different requirements in mind, it was like, oh, there's so much specialized stuff in here that doesn't exist in, you know, the new MVC that you just got to rewrite this part.
I think that's fair. I think it does depend. It depends on how much you tweak things. So like if you wrote your own, you know, view context resolver trigger paradigm implementation factory, or, you know, like there's a million ways where you can tweak, you can write your own view engine, you can write your own, you know, routing handlers, you can write your own, like, all kinds of stuff, file providers. So people that really tweaked their MVC, that's harder to update. If you were doing, like, if you're doing very simple models, views, and controllers, it still is a rewrite, but you can copy a lot of stuff over. Like, your views are just HTML.
Yeah, it turns into change the framework or the runtime, and then just fix the squiggles or the yellow screens that you see versus web forms your host.
Web forms you really need to, like, re-architect and or, you know, like, I've talked to people, like, the main recommendation is, hey, if it works and it's existing stuff and, you know, like, just keep doing what you're doing. But if it's something where it's like you're going to continue to develop it and you do want to keep it modern and stuff, then you look at, like, separating things out. There's some different features, like WebForms has model binding and you can use that to migrate to MVC and then update it. Or there's this project, I'm a fan, they just joined .NET Foundation. There's a project called .VVM, which is an MVVM style thing that works both on OWN and ASP.NET Core. And so projects, and I talked to the guy, Tomas, who's led this project, and they work with, like, a lot of banks and government things and stuff where they have web forms, they need to update them. And so they'll convert the front end to use this .VVM. And then you end up, like, having these services that work with them. Anyways, it works with both. So you can, the nice thing with that is you can incrementally update. So you can have some parts of the site are just straight up web forms. And then, you know, maybe your new development, you start doing that with .VVM and you convert stuff over a bit at a time. So that's an option. And then Razor Pages and Blazor are other, like, you know, kind of leapfrog. Blazor is interesting because it has a component model again. So a lot of people I've talked to, you know, I'm like, just do MVC. It's not that bad. And they're like, I want my components. And I'm used to, you know, like, I'm used to having components and web forms and I, you know, drop a control on and set properties and write event code. And, you know,
where's my page lifecycle? I need my page lifecycle.
Right, exactly. And your strange controller index method frightens me and stuff. So that is part of, like, the component model for Blazor is kind of similar to, like, the components you'll see in, like, React and Angular and Vue and stuff. Like, you know, especially more, I guess, like, I don't know, maybe like a React component. But so the idea there is you can, you know, and there's even, vendors. So, like, vendors are shipping a grid component or a report, you know, chart component or stuff like that. So, you know, for somebody that's, like, for a shop that's used to, you know, developing using components for web stuff, that's kind of like a more natural transition. Wow, this is a long answer. Well, so I guess the last thing of what doesn't come to .NET 5, there's a few things like
Silverlight
workflow.
Ooh, Silverlight.
Yes, you said it. Well, so, you know, I still remind people of that you wrote a short post that was like, Silverlight is the future, but the future isn't Silverlight. And I love that post because it's like,
yeah,
I think it was so true. Like, all the stuff that was in Silverlight, the, you know, vector graphics and you know, fast, like, compiled code. And,
yeah,
you know, like,
it's basically, it's Blazor, but with components.
Right. So, well, and it's a web standard. So yeah. the thing that killed Silverlight was you needed all the browser vendors to like, you know, allow and support this plugin. And, you know, they all didn't want to because they were fighting it and it wasn't web standard and stuff. Yeah. And now WebAssembly is all web standard.
Now they snuck it in and ha ha ha. You can't get rid of it now. Ha ha.
It's funny. It's so, like, I think it's neat. I have mixed feelings because I don't know. There's, like, I'm a web developer and a .NET developer, and I love all the kind of my comfortable ways of developing .NET or web stuff. But I'm not super comfortable, and I don't think I ever will be, with a lot of the front end frameworks, the Angulars and the Reacts and stuff.
No one should be comfortable with Angular. No one.
Right?
No one.
So I'm more comfortable with Blazor than I am with like Angular or whatever. But so those sessions at Build and everywhere I go, people are like fanatical about the Blazor. They pack them out and they wave signs and they say, "We love you, Daniel and Steve Sanderson and all you."
Yeah, sure. Girls. Just like they were about Silverlight and WPF, WCF. And...
You know, there you go.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah, so,
I may have tapped into something here.
Well, again, this is built on a cross-platform browser standard thing. So it's not like trying to get people to do some wacky thing. It's like, hey, you're running on standard browser stuff. Yep. I don't know.
Yeah, sounds great. Sure.
Okay. One other thing is I do talk to people that are like, and I've talked to people that do training for like Angular and stuff like that. And they're like, you know, like, okay. Well, and Kay Scott's mentioned this too. So I'm like, right. Like, so he'll train people on here's how to do Angular development. And they're mostly a .NET shop, but then they need to do some single page app front end stuff. And so they're not great at Angular, but they learn enough to be dangerous. And it's like, if you're building like, if you have a, you know, kick butt web shop and they totally get Angular and all that, like, of course do that. But if you have a web shop that's like, okay, we're all .NET devs, but we got to write some Angular stuff and we'll make it work, I think. Like, I would rather, in that case, like, just write your .NET code and you can reuse your libraries.
Or if your company's name happens to be Accenture and you're working for Hertz.
Nice. I don't know exactly what you do then, but I know the lawyers line up, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What was the deal there? They basically outsourced a whole lot of stuff, and they're like, we're just depending on Accenture to do everything.
They even outsourced the project management.
What could go wrong?
Like, they thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, to be fair, project management sucks. I would pay somebody else to do it, too.
You know, you might want to have a liaison maybe with their project management if you're outsourcing it. Yeah. I don't know. Some kind of stakeholder who could say yes or no, or hey, have you actually built anything yet?
Right.
And the best part of that was when they fired Accenture and brought in the new people and like, oh yeah, we got to throw out all this. And I'm like, of course they did. Because that's what the new guy does.
That's the first job of every new king is to throw down all the idols of the old
That's
king.
Right. We got to get rid of all this code. No. No, none of it is usable. None of it.
The previous people were all terrible.
This is all bad. Everything's got to go. We'll do it right, though.
Yeah, trust us. And on that note, it's just about an hour. I think we should maybe wrap up.
Yeah, I got to go pick up my daughter from track practice. I don't know where she gets this track stuff from. It's not from me.
Hooray. Okay. Great success. I think I have a button here that I can, so I have a few different drum options and none of them are actually correct. I should fix that, but there's this one, but really the one I'm looking for is this.
I thought it was going to be the sad trombone. I thought it was going to be the sad trombone. Wah, wah, wah.